Good afternoon, and welcome back to the University of Chicago for Alumni Weekend. My name is Tracy Teibel. I'm the Director of Development here at the Oriental Institute, and it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's Uncommon Core session, which is on our new and exciting project with the National Museum of Afghanistan. You'll be hearing from Professor Gil Stein, who is part of the team that is managing this project, and it's pretty exciting and gives you a rare opportunity to see some of the treasures of the museum and get a little flavor for what it's like in Afghanistan these days. But my job is to tell you a little bit more about Gil Stein. Gil is director of the Oriental Institute and professor of Near Eastern Archaeology in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations here at the University of Chicago. He received his bachelor's degree with honors in archaeology from Yale University, I won't tell you the year, and his PhD in anthropology from the University of Pennsylvania. He has excavated and surveyed in the American Southwest, Turkey, and Syria. He has been a National Science Foundation graduate fellow, a Fulbright scholar in Turkey, a postdoctoral fellow at the Smithsonian Institution, and a resident scholar at the School of American Research. His main research interests focus on the development of early civilizations in the Near East and the archaeology of ancient colonies. He has also conducted research on ancient urbanism, the economic organization of the earliest state societies, and zooarchaeology. If you've ever been in the office when a box of bones comes in from another university, it's really fun to watch Gil's reaction to that. He has written over 40 journal articles, book chapters, and reviews, along with the book Rethinking World Systems, Diasporas, Colonies, and Interaction in Uruk, Mesopotamia. His most recent edited volume is The Archaeology of Colonial Encounters, Comparative Perspectives, which is published by the SAR Press. From 1992 to 1997, he directed excavations at the ancient Mesopotamian trading colony of Hajinabi in the Euphrates River Valley of southeast Turkey. Most recently, from 2008 to 2010, he directed our own Oriental Institute excavations at the prehistoric 6th to 5th millennium BC site of Tel Zaidan, also in the Euphrates Valley, Syria. And since 2012, he has been co-director of the Oriental Institute's partnership with the National Museum of Afghanistan in Kabul. This is a three-year project funded by the United States State Department to develop a computer database for the museum and conduct a complete inventory of the objects in its collections. Please join me in welcoming Gil Stein.
Well, thank you, Tracy, and I want to thank all of you for, one, for coming back to Hyde Park, and two, for making your pilgrimage into the Oriental Institute. We're delighted to welcome you. The topic of my talk today is, I think, really emblematic of some of the best things that the University of Chicago has to offer, that it's a place where one comes and one may have one idea about what you want to study, what you want to be, what you want to do, and then you encounter things and you learn things and you're exposed to things that really shift around your whole way of thinking and get you to view the world in a totally different way that you never expected. And I have to say that I'm a Middle Eastern archaeologist, I'm a prehistorian, and I never really thought I would end up doing a project working in Afghanistan, but I have, and I'm very humbled and honored to be able to do that, and it has opened my eyes to a whole new way of seeing the work that I've been doing over the last 20 years by looking at it from the eastern edge of the Middle East, from Afghanistan. So you all probably have heard of the famous 19th century satirist Ambrose Bierce. He wrote a book called The Devil's Dictionary, which is, even 150 years later, it's pretty hilarious. And one of the most biting things that Ambrose Bierce wrote was, he said, "War is God's way of teaching Americans geography." And that hurts, but it's actually pretty true. I think that most of us in the United States don't know a lot about Afghanistan, and what we do know is very highly colored by what we read in the news. That's a similar problem to the way Americans have thought about Iraq and Iran and other places. So what I'd like to do today are two things. One is to just give you an introduction to just what's out there in Afghanistan. Why is it such an incredibly interesting place, not just as a place in the headlines, but as a real treasury of cultures and historical developments. Then I'd like to just very briefly run through some of the very tragic recent history of Afghanistan, very briefly. And then I want to talk about what the University of Chicago and the Oriental Institute, what we're doing to try and help to rebuild the structure, the infrastructure for cultural heritage preservation in Afghanistan, how we're trying to save these very, very precious traces of the rich archaeological history of Afghanistan. So to start with, Afghanistan is situated right here, east of Iran, south of Turkmenistan, and north of Pakistan. And it's very important. It's interesting that no one ever quite knows where to put Afghanistan. Is Afghanistan part of South Asia? Is it part of Central Asia? Is it part of the Middle East? And the answer is yes. It's all of them. It's a kind of a cliche, but it happens to be a very true cliche that Afghanistan is the crossroads of Asia. And this is one of the most interesting things that I encountered. It was one of the most surprising things for me. And I hope I can convey a little bit of that to you today, that Afghanistan for literally millennia has been one of those places where the cultural influences go in every direction. There are connections to China, there are connections to Central Asia, there are connections to Iran and Mesopotamia and the remainder of the Middle East, and there are connections to India, to South Asia, Pakistan and India. And these influences and cross-cultural currents have really shaped Afghanistan over the millennia. So, in following with Ambrose Bierce's dictum, I just wanted to very quickly flash these two maps on there because more than anything else, they helped me to understand, at least begin to understand the complexity of Afghanistan. The big thing is that Afghanistan doesn't have a kind of geographical unity that the way many countries in the world do. It's a place that is a deeply divided and fragmented geographical landscape, and therefore it's a deeply divided and fragmented cultural landscape, and the two are really closely connected. So the big fact of life is the Hindu Kush Mountains. Hindu Kush means the slayer of Hindus, I guess because it's going from a nice warm place to a brutally cold place, or just a plain brutal place. So the Hindu Kush cuts across Afghanistan from east to west, and so the areas to the north of the Hindu Kush are very much closely aligned to Central Asia. The areas to the west of it are closely tied to Iran, places like the famous city of Herat or Baluchistan. And the areas to the south of the Hindu Kush are very closely tied to South Asia, Pakistan, and India. And the very eastern section has those very important links eastward into China. So geography really shapes Afghanistan, and you can see that fragmentation imposed by the Hindu Kush. You see it in, this is one of those great anthropological maps of different ethno-linguistic groups. So the whole southern part of the country, the light green, is the area of the Pashtun, and the Taliban insurgency is almost entirely Pashtun speakers. In the middle, way up in the mountains, are the Hazaras. The Hazaras are the only Shiite group in Afghanistan. They're very Asiatic in their physical appearance. They describe themselves as descendants of Genghis Khan. And those of you who read that wonderful novel, The Kite Runner, may remember that the main character was a Hazara boy. In the east is the area of the Tajiks. The Tajiks were the people who formed the Northern Alliance, the one group that managed to hold out against the Taliban. And to the north are the Uzbeks, Turkic speakers, very much connected with Central Asia. And then Kabul, you can see why Kabul is such a strategic prize, because that's the place where the Pashtun area, the Hazara area, and the Tajik area all come together. So I think this is one of those situations where geography and culture really connect in very logical ways, but very complex ways. And it's this diverse and fragmented character of Afghanistan, its character as the place in the middle, that crossroads, that has shaped the archaeological history and richness of Afghanistan over the millennia. And where we first start to see this is in the early Bronze Age, which is the time when the first cities really developed and spread throughout the Middle East. And these earliest cities were very much part of what we have to think of as a globalized society, that connections between cultures ranged across vast areas, connections of trade, connections of shared cultural ideas, and we can track this kind of thing because we can reconstruct the trade routes that the early Sumerian civilization of Mesopotamia was trading across the Iranian plateau all the way up into the mountains of Afghanistan for really precious items that the Mesopotamians didn't have. They had no way of accessing at home and had to get from abroad things like gold and lapis lazuli and tin, which might surprise you at first, but tin is one of the key components in making bronze. That's when you alloy 10% tin with 90% copper, you get a very, very strong bronze implement. And tin is very hard to find. It's actually quite rare, but it is there in Afghanistan. And lapis lazuli is probably the most beautiful one of those markers that lets us really reconstruct these incredibly long-distance trade relations that bound Afghanistan to the rest of the Middle East. Lapis lazuli, as you know, and you can see in our gift shop outside, lapis lazuli is a beautiful blue semi-precious stone. The prettiest kind is flecked with a sort of gold flecks or pyrite flecks, and it was highly prized by the people of the Middle East because when you combined it with gold, you were able to replicate the University of Michigan colors. So you'll see lapis lazuli showing up in almost every kind of royal burial or elite context in the Middle East. This is the very famous sculpture. Many of you have probably seen it in the British Museum. Sir Leonard Woolley found it at the Royal Cemetery of Ur, one of the great cities of southern Mesopotamia, the homeland of the patriarch Abraham. The ram in the thicket, if you look, the curled corkscrew-shaped horns of that goat, or ram, actually, are lapis lazuli. When you look at the fabled city of Ebla in Syria, this sculpture of the Anzu bird, the messenger of the storm god and intermediary to the underworld, the Anzu bird, the whole central part of it is made of lapis lazuli. At Ebla, they found blocks of lapis lazuli that had clearly been traded in the raw form over vast distances from Afghanistan. And then the famous royal standard of Ur is an inlay with mother of pearl, and everything around it is lapis lazuli. So you have to think of this as an incredibly valuable item in the ancient world, and really just about the only source was these mountains in northeast Afghanistan. This is the Wakhan Corridor linking Afghanistan to China. This is that whole Tajik area in the north, and it's incredibly rich in minerals. There's rubies, emeralds, lapis lazuli, gold. They've also found recently the world's largest copper deposit. The largest known copper deposit on the planet Earth is also there in Afghanistan. So this is a place of tremendous wealth, and it was linked to the rest of the ancient world because of it. And as part of that, we see just as cities developed in Sumer, the heartland of cities in Mesopotamia, there were also very large, fortified, diverse cities developing in Afghanistan in this early Bronze Age of the third millennium BC. And I just want to show you, pictures of, this is Gonur Tepe. It's an aerial photo. It's a very large walled city. And then I love this. This is Dashli Tepe, a very heavily fortified citadel and a city around it. We can see that these cities were connected to the rest of the Middle East through by looking at the art styles of the objects that come out of them. Those of you who've been to the Louvre or to the Metropolitan Museum in New York will find these wonderful ladies. They're known as the Bactrian princesses, and they're carved out of soapstone or chlorite with limestone heads. And it's a style that's very widely distributed across the Middle East. From the site of Tepe Fulal in Afghanistan, we find these gold bowls, these like 4,500-year-old gold bowls, and they have bull men on them, these hybrid creatures, half bull, half human, that are very, very characteristic of Mesopotamian and Sumerian art. And what are they doing all the way up there in Afghanistan? We also find artwork that would be very much at home in Iran, so these composite figures of silver and gold with a very, very high level of both technology and superb craftsmanship, also in Afghanistan. So when you look at all that, the cities, the gold, the artwork, the international styles, it shows you that Afghanistan was very closely connected to the rest of the Middle East. Even though we don't tend to think of it that way, it was absolutely a part of the Middle East and its civilizations. Now, we know a lot more about Afghanistan in what we'd call the Iron Age, basically especially the 6th to the 4th centuries BC, because Afghanistan was a key part of the Persian Empire of Darius and Xerxes. The Persian Empire was enormous. Those of you familiar with the Bible, you know how the book of Esther refers to the Persian Empire as stretching from India as far as Ethiopia. And that's literally true. This is the eastern edges of the Persian Empire where the Indus Valley, and it stretched all the way down to Nubia. From Nubia to the steppes of Asia, from the Indus all the way into Thrace in modern Greece. So when you just look at it, the whole eastern half of the Persian Empire, Afghanistan is at the very, very heart of it. And it was extremely important to the Persian Empire. Some of the main satrapies or provinces were all located here. Bactria is one of the most important ones. Bactria, as it turns out, is the birthplace of the prophet Zoroaster, the founder of Zoroastrianism. Alexander the Great ended up marrying a princess from Bactria. So this is the walls of Balkh or Bactra, and it's enormous. It's almost incalculable how big this site is and how ancient. No archaeologist has ever gotten to the bottom of it, but we assume it's one of the most ancient cities in this part of the world. From Afghanistan come a number of treasures that you might have seen in the British Museum called the Oxus treasure, found in the Oxus River Valley, and I think the Oxus is sort of running right around here, right around there. And it's beautiful gold work, spectacular gold work, these armlets, these cast gold statuettes showing magi, the Zoroastrian priesthood of the Persian Empire, charioteers, incredible stuff, which gives us just a hint at both the wealth of the Persian Empire and of the importance of Afghanistan within the Persian Empire. Of course, you know that wherever the Persians went, this gentleman followed them, and this is Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great, in his conquests, after he had defeated the Persian king, he pursued Darius all the way into Afghanistan, and the whole eastern chunk of the Persian Empire had to be pacified. And I think everyone recognizes, of all of Alexander's campaigns, the Afghan campaign was the single toughest one he ever had to deal with, that he just faced this frustration of conquering a village and moving on and then finding out that those people just wouldn't stay conquered. And he ended up having to wage a very, very brutal counterinsurgency in Afghanistan for several years. He ended it by basically taking all the local warlords, saying, okay, you're provincial governors now, I'll marry your daughters, just stay calm and move on, which may sound kind of familiar to you. One of the key elements here, we don't think of Alexander the Great as having campaigned in the area. We remember that he went all the way as far as India, crossed the Indus River, and then finally his troops rebelled and said, really, it's time to go home. And so Alexander turned back at that point, having more or less pacified Afghanistan, but just barely. It's what's afterwards that's fantastic. We know that Alexander the Great founded colonies wherever he went. And historically, we knew that he had been setting up colonies in those conquered Persian satrapies of Bactra and Araya and Margiana and Sogdiana. But no one ever found any until the 30s, when French archaeologists discovered this amazing site called Ay Hanum, which means Lady Moon. Ay is moon in Turkish and Persian. And we think it's Alexandria on the Oxus River, right here. And this is one of the easternmost colonies that was set up by Alexander the Great and his successors. And I want you to try and imagine what it's like to have a place on the Oxus River, really in the back of beyond, as far as the Greco-Rome, well, the world of Greece and Macedon is concerned, and having a gymnasium, an agora, a theater, Greek inscriptions everywhere, Greek theatrical masks, Greek coins, an entire Greek city transplanted to the Oxus River. And that gives you an idea of the linkages between the Mediterranean world now and Afghanistan. So Afghanistan was very much a part of this, and the Hellenistic legacy in Afghanistan is really impressive and affects our world in very unexpected ways. One of the first things to realize is that the Greek Macedonian colonies didn't disappear. They lasted for two or three centuries after Alexander, and we call them the Greco-Bactrian kingdoms. One of the neatest things you can do is look at the coinage of these Greco-Bactrian kingdoms, and they start off as Greek could be. But over the years, they get more and more sort of orientalized, more and more hybridized and acculturated to the local cultures of Afghanistan. And so they start looking more and more different. And as much as the local cultures were affecting these Hellenistic kingdoms, these Hellenistic kingdoms were affecting the local cultures of Afghanistan and creating a new kind of cultural fusion. We see that cultural fusion in its most striking form at a site called Bagram, which most of us would know of as Bagram Air Force Base, about 45 kilometers north of Kabul. That's the major Air Force route in and out of Afghanistan. But it turns out there was a very ancient settlement at Bagram, again, excavated by French archaeologists. And what they found was amazing. The site dates to about the first centuries BC and AD, and they found several rooms there, just treasury rooms filled with artifacts that you'd never expect to see together. They reflect that whole role of Afghanistan as a crossroads of cultures. Some of the most beautiful of them are the Bagram ivories, which you might have seen in the British Museum. They've been on tour in exhibits around the world, and they're very, very clearly Indian, South Asian in their entire character. So you have those. You have lacquer work from China. You have Roman bronze sculptures. And then I think nothing exemplifies the character of Bagram as much as this rock-cut crystal vase. What that is showing you is that's one of the largest known depictions of the lighthouse in Alexandria, this large tower with the statue of on top of it. It's 3,700 kilometers from Alexandria over here all the way across to Bagram. And yet, someone there at Bagram had probably been to Alexandria and seen the lighthouse and brought this back maybe as a souvenir, or whether it was traded and purchased in Bagram, it doesn't matter. The point is, this was an interconnected world. And we're only talking about the western half of it, because Bagram was at the heart. It was a pivotal point on the whole Silk Road that linked the civilizations of Han China all the way across to the Roman Empire and the Mediterranean world. Afghanistan was at the heart of this trading network. It was at the heart of these intermingling cultural influences, which had an enormous effect on history. Now, I mentioned how these Hellenistic colonies of Alexander the Great had a very deep effect. You don't see that anywhere as powerfully as you do with the effect of Hellenistic art on the emergence of Buddhism and Buddhist art. The Buddha lived in the 5th century in India, and Buddhist ideas migrated out of India into Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is the route by which Buddhism reached China. We don't think about that, but it's very, very visible. So you have a fusion of this South Asian religion with the artistic canons of Hellenistic civilization. For the first couple of centuries after the death of the Buddha, it was aniconic. You didn't actually show the Buddha. You only hinted at his presence by a parasol or the tree under which he meditated and achieved true enlightenment. But they didn't actually depict the Buddha until what's called the Gandharan period. So the Gandharan period sees these earliest depictions of the Buddha, and it's very clear how strongly influenced this early Buddhist art is by Hellenistic art, that the earliest Buddhas basically look like Alexander the Great with the dot on his forehead, pretty much. And it's only later that the depictions become more and more Asiatic in character. And so it's through that route up from India across into China. That's how Buddhism spread. And as it spread, this art morphed. But the very earliest evidence of Buddhist art comes from Afghanistan. And these are some of the greatest treasures of the National Museum in Afghanistan. At about the same time as the Silk Road was operating, this was also a time of the great nomadic movements across Central Asia. And we in the West know about them with when we think about the Attila the Hun and the invasions of the Huns into Europe. The Huns were Central Asian Turkic groups. There were whole groups of nomads from Western China and from the steppes of Central Asia who were progressively moving west. This is also a time of great nomadic invasions into Afghanistan. And yet again, you see this incredible fusion taking place. These are some of the most beautiful objects to come out of Afghanistan that we know of. And these were also on this tour, this touring exhibit of the Bactrian gold from Afghanistan. They come from a site called Tilya Tepe in northern Afghanistan from about the first century AD. They found the tombs of like six nomadic princes of a group probably called the Uaji, who became, when they settled in Afghanistan, they're probably the ones who became the Kushan dynasty, that first major Buddhist dynasty in Afghanistan. But when you look at the art, I just want to juxtapose these two objects from the contemporaneous tombs. One of them is it's showing Dionysus and Ariadne in a completely Hellenistic kind of scene. I think you can see that with these, you know, holding garlands and satyrs and all, you know, the whole complex of elements in Hellenistic art. And that's occurring with this guy here, who's a very Central Asian, Western Chinese looking shamanic figure, and he's sort of the master of these two dragons. So you have in the same tombs this complete mixture of the Hellenistic world and the world of Central Asia and East Asia in the art and archaeology of Afghanistan. Afghanistan also is very closely tied to the Middle East through the Islamic cultures and civilizations. And the Arab conquest reached all the way across the Iranian plateau and into Afghanistan. So we have Balkh, that same place where the Zoroaster was born, that same city, Balkh. It's also the birthplace of the Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. Before he settled in Rum, the land of Rum, the Byzantine lands of Anatolia, he was called Mevlana Jalaluddin Balkhi because he was from Balkh or Bactria. So some of the most beautiful poetry that we know of from the Middle East and Sufism and mysticism in Islam, it all originates with this guy from a great center of Islamic learning in Afghanistan. So I guess you could say Bactria is sort of zoned for religion, and that persists over the millennia. Herat, the city of Herat was in northwest Afghanistan, was a famous center of Persian civilization. And I just wanted to point this out to you. This is what we would normally call just a Persian miniature. Well, it's made in Herat. Herat was very much part of the Persian world. We also have Mazar-i-Sharif, the magnificent mosque in Mazar-i-Sharif that is thought to have been the burial place of Ali, the Caliph Ali, who was, of course, married to Muhammad's daughter. So Afghanistan was very much tied into the Islamic world of the Middle East. Well, the last aspect of that is Kabul itself was the first capital of Babur, who was the founder of the Mughal dynasty that conquered India. We think of the Mughals as very Indian, but they originate basically in Afghanistan and then spread out from there. The more recent history of Afghanistan is much more tragic, of course, with civil war, the Soviet invasion in 1978, the terrible decade of guerrilla warfare that and occupation that depopulated the country, sent millions of refugees into neighboring areas, devastated the country, and that the country is still recovering from. And this is where our story comes in. What happened afterwards? After the Soviet withdrawal, Afghanistan was plunged into civil war. Eventually, in 1995, the Taliban emerged as the most powerful force. The Pashtun dominated Taliban, captured Kabul, took over almost all of the country except that little northeast corner. And as part of the Taliban rule was a very, very radical fundamentalist form of Islam that most Muslims, I think, would not agree with as an acceptable form. But it sought a kind of purity that meant that any kind of graven images were idolatry. And most of us, I think, first started paying attention to the Taliban when they did things like blow up the Buddhas of Bamiyan. The Buddhas of Bamiyan are one of the greatest treasures of civilization. This is a picture of the larger of the two Buddhas. And I just want to call your attention to these little dots down there. Those are people, and that's the taller standing Buddha. It was blown up over the course of several days by the Taliban in 2001, and this is what it looks like now, this empty niche carved into the cliffs of the beautiful valley of Bamiyan. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg. During this decade of civil war and Taliban rule, the National Museum of Afghanistan was as devastated or even more devastated than the rest of the country. That here you see the building of the National Museum totally bombed out. It was on the borderland, the boundary between two warring factions of the Afghan warlords. Something like 70% of the museum collections were looted or destroyed, and we estimate that's something like 140,000 objects, okay? I just want to put that into perspective for you. All of you have heard of the looting of the Baghdad Museum. Do you know how many objects were looted from the Baghdad Museum? 15,000. So multiply that by 100, all right? It's amazing. Not by 100, by 10, sorry. Humanities. Anyway, so the museum was devastated. And equally bad, 90% of their museum records were destroyed. Here's a picture of some of the pitiful survivors of that devastation. These are the records of the museum. It was absolutely devastated by being caught in the middle. And even worse, once the civil war was over and the Taliban controlled it, they then went into the museum, and what was left, they took sledgehammers to it. So here you see one of those treasures of the earliest Buddhist art from like the 4th century, 2nd to 5th century. It was completely smashed up with sledgehammers. And then the heroic staff of the National Museum waited till the Taliban left, swept up all the pieces, and then glued that statue back together again. So you see, here's the label. It says, broken in 2001. That's a very nice euphemism for what happened. And the devastation was, the extent of it, we're still trying to figure out how bad it was. When our team was back in, our Chicago team was back in Afghanistan and Kabul in March, I took these pictures in the storerooms. These are statues from Hada, a very important Gandharan early Buddhist site, smashed completely with sledgehammers. You can still see the very fresh, clean breaks from the Taliban's sledgehammers. The museum was devastated. When, in 2001, when the United States forces and their allies defeated the Taliban, retook Kabul, and tried to start the process of rebuilding the country, the museum was devastated. The first step in reconstructing it, after the terrible events in Baghdad, the United States understood the importance of preserving cultural heritage, and it understood that places like the National Museum are extremely important touchstones for defining the identity of these countries, like their whole history. This is the repository where it's stored. And what happens to a country when all of that gets destroyed? So it's been a major priority for the United States to try and rebuild the museum. The first stage was actually rebuilding the structure, the physical structure of the museum. Here you can see it bombed out, no glass left in the windows. This is it in 2001. And then this is it now. These are the galleries, one of the galleries of the National Museum, 2001. This is it now. It's really inspiring to see how it's been rebuilt. And all kinds of amazing things started to surface once the Taliban were gone. One of the most amazing ones is all that gold from Tilya Tepe that I was showing you with Dionysus and the Central Asian shaman. That was all hidden away beneath the presidential palace in a vault where the people from the National Museum broke off the keys in the lock and of the vault and just kept their mouths shut for like 10 years. The Taliban never knew what was literally underneath their feet. And this picture, it's great. It shows the moment when they opened up the vault and took out, completely intact, all those golden treasures. This is this wonderful Russian archaeologist, Viktor Saryaniti, the man who had excavated those treasures. Never thought he'd see them again. And you can see how moved he is to actually see those things again. So things did survive. And that they survived is because of this man, Dr. Omara Khan Masoudi. I'm calling him doctor because he was recently honored by receiving an honorary degree from New York University in recognition of his heroic efforts to preserve Afghan culture. He kept the museum together through that entire dark period when it was being looted and shelled. He had no money. He was selling potatoes as a vegetable vendor on the street to be able to support himself and keep the museum going. So it's, I think, a very satisfying thing for him to see his museum physically reborn. But rebuilding a building is one thing. It's the contents that are really the important part of it. And that's where the State Department recognized that had to be dealt with as well. So they issued a call for proposals to do for a 3-year grant to form a partnership between the United States and the National Museum of Afghanistan to rebuild their infrastructure. And what they wanted us to do is to develop a database of all the holdings in the museum. Remember, no one even knows what's in there anymore. And then with that database, conduct a complete inventory, look at of everything that's there. No one's ever done that. Figure out the conservation status, what needs to be treated and conserved and restored, and then rehouse all the objects in archival containers, acid-free boxes, and then train the staff of the museum in best practices of museum management so that when the grant's over and when the foreigners leave, they will have a functioning museum where they know exactly what's in their museum and will know how to manage those collections. And the Oriental Institute, we're very honored that we received this grant. It's $2.8 million. It's the largest grant that we've ever gotten. And we were very honored to receive it. And I think one of the reasons that they awarded it to the Oriental Institute is because our mission is very much in keeping with what the State Department wanted to see done, that our mission is discovery, preservation, and outreach. And all of those things are involved in the goals of the project. So we're very good with databases. We have a lot of experience with them, databases at all levels of Oracle, museum management software databases, and smaller scale FileMaker Pro databases that you can run on a computer. One of the reasons we got the grant is that we opted for a low-tech approach, that we're going to create a database that's going to be simple and sustainable. A database that resides on a laptop computer can survive when electricity goes out. You don't need that. You got batteries. It's not something where you need access to the internet to run it. I like to think of it as the Chevy pickup of databases. And so instead of proposing something really elaborate that would not, that you wouldn't be able to sustain after we, if the foreigners leave, we wanted something simple, easy to run. You can buy the software off the shelf and customize it. And that's what we did. We also have a lot of experience with museums. We have a beautiful museum outside. If you haven't seen it, I hope you will visit it. We have something like 300,000 registered objects. We have 8 permanent galleries. We do 2 special exhibits every year. We have an advanced artifact conservation laboratory, curators, registrars, the whole the whole panoply. And we have a lot of deep commitment to preserving cultural heritage. We do rescue excavations to save sites before they're flooded by dams. We do architectural restoration and recording. We fight against looting and smuggling, and we train our colleagues in Middle Eastern museums. So this is part of our commitment to preserving the past. Here's an example in Egypt. Those of you who've been to Chicago House of Luxor know that the Oriental Institute has spent the last like 80 years working on preserving the monuments of Luxor and Thebes. After the looting of the museum in Baghdad, we set up a website called Iraq's Lost Heritage, where we put up pictures of every object that we had excavated that's in the Baghdad Museum. We collected pictures from other excavations so that law enforcement officials would know and would be able to catch smugglers trying to smuggle out this stolen art from Iraq. So that's part of how we're trying to use the internet to prevent and fight looting. We also have brought, we've had two NEH grants where we brought archaeological conservators from Iraq to Hyde Park, to the Oriental Institute, and also four conservators from Afghanistan. And we taught them English as a second language, and then we spent 5 months training them in advanced archaeological conservation, and then they went back home. So we had a pool of experience that we could bring to help the National Museum in Afghanistan. And we started our project in just about a year ago. We're coming up on the first anniversary of the first year of our 3-year project. And I just wanted to quickly show you, give you an idea of what Kabul is like. It's grown to be an enormous city of 5.5 million people, many of whom are living in sort of very difficult shantytown conditions. And yet you also have like really advanced cell phone technology going on. You have very strong Islamic influences from Iran and other countries. Everywhere you see pictures of this man, Ahmed Shah Massoud, the Lion of Panjshir. He was the head of the resistance against the Taliban. This is a monument to Ahmed Shah Massoud right outside in the square right next to the American Embassy. But it's a country at war. It's a city on the highest security alert. Everywhere you go, it's like driving down the bottom of a canal. There are these high blast walls on every side of the street. There are these surveillance balloons that the Afghans call the white frogs that are hovering over Kabul, monitoring and looking for insurgent activities. The Darul Aman Palace, right next to the National Museum, is still bombed out from the Afghan Civil War. There's one of the white frogs up there. And yet there are these little oases there. This is the French Institute, as you might expect. They live very well. And it's a beautiful place, and they've been very hospitable to us, and we're really grateful to our colleagues there, and Philippe Marquis, the head of the French delegation there. It's an archaeological library, an archaeological center, and that's where we've been working. But even there, you get this total contradiction between playing ping pong and the good life, having cocktails out on the terrace, and then upstairs in the hallway, there's body armor and helmets right out there, so you can put them on the minute you need them. This is our crew, this is Philippe Marquis, the head of DAFA, Laura Tedesco from the U.S. State Department, and our team in Kabul. We have some people who are there, pretty much living there pretty much year-round, and then we have a Chicago part of the team doing the management from Chicago. We set out to sort of work with our Afghan colleagues in the museum, talking about databases, how databases work, what databases can do for them. And it turns out they're actually pretty technologically savvy. They know a lot about it. They understood the benefits of developing this database and have worked very closely with us in developing it. We worked with their conservation staff, including some of the people whom we ourselves had trained like just a couple of years before. So it was a real reunion. We learned how they register items in their own museum, what their existing procedures were. We looked at their storerooms to see what they were like, some of which are in very good shape. This is Ai Khanum, that Greek colony, the objects from there. And then others are reasonably well organized, like the ceramics. And then you have just bags and bags of uncatalogued artifacts, things just stacked on the shelves, unlabeled, with no records, all over the place. So these storerooms are vast. There are tens of thousands of objects in there, and it's a big job. There are some paper inventory records since 2001, and we've been very interested in integrating them into what we do. So what our project is doing is we set up a FileMaker Pro database that's integrating the pre-existing paper records. There were some initial attempts at databases, and then all of those tens of thousands of objects sitting in the storerooms that haven't been looked at yet. This is Michael Fisher, our field director, and Michael is working with one of his Afghan colleagues, and Michael is entering the data in English, and our colleague is entering it in Dari, the national language of one of the national languages of Afghanistan, and the two are merged together into a bilingual database. Here you can see the Dari, here you can see the English. We're also doing conservation work while we put the objects into the database, and we've made extraordinary progress. In 1 year, we've now coded, inventoried 10,000 objects from scratch, and we have 50,000 to go in the next 2 years. So the question is, what happens when we're gone? A lot of people say, why are you bothering to do this? My dad said to me, all you're doing is cleaning up the collections for the Taliban. And my answer is, this is very important work. We cannot tell the future. We don't know what's going to happen. These kids, boys and girls, what kind of a future are they going to inherit? You should notice they're sitting in a schoolhouse. There are now 8.5 million Afghan kids in school learning how to read, including women for the first time ever. Things are changing in Afghanistan. There is a chance of a better future. We have no idea how it'll play out. But one thing that is certain, it's absolutely dead certain, that if we don't preserve the heritage of Afghanistan, these people will be living their lives in a vacuum. And I think it's said beautifully by this stone inscription outside of the museum that says, a nation stays alive when its culture stays alive. And I'm very proud that the University of Chicago can be playing a role in that effort. I think it's the one of the best things we can do. We can only hope that it'll succeed. Thank you for your patience. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are. Yes, ma'am. That's a wonderful question. The question is, the French have done a tremendous amount of very high quality archaeology in Afghanistan. Are we able to use their records? The short answer is yes. And we also rely on their expertise. So we bring them in as consultants to help us with the identification of objects. And that's in fact been, that was our point of entry, is working with French records and putting them into a computerized database. So we're very lucky. We're sort of standing on the shoulders of giants. Any other questions? Yes, in the back. The question is, have any of the 140,000 objects been recovered? And again, the answer is yes. At least some of them have. Mostly, they've vanished. They're being held. They're either in private collections or antiquities dealers are holding onto them until things cool down a bit. But the customs officials in places like Heathrow Airport in London, they periodically find big caches of objects being smuggled out of Afghanistan. Most of them are from newly looted sites that no one in the world of archaeology scholarship even knows about. The objects are just showing up. And those have been repatriated. We've also had some museum objects, like pieces of Bagram ivories, have come back. So just in the last year, the British Museum sent back a shipment of something like 5,000 objects from Afghanistan that had been confiscated in Heathrow Airport, and we've now inventoried them. So there are some small successes, which is kind of encouraging. Other questions? Yes, in the very far back. Okay, is this something we would share? There are two aspects of that. One is the database structure, and the other is the contents of it. Because the Afghans are very careful. They do not want this on the internet. They do not want it circulated, because they basically feel that would be like painting a target on their backs, that it would be just an invitation for the looters to come back. So they don't want that information out there. That's for internal use. On the other hand, the development of FileMaker Pro databases, I think it's a great idea, and we're very interested in sharing that kind of knowledge. This one in particular is highly customized because we made it bilingual and things like that. But the basic skeleton of it is something we're very happy to share, and we're hoping that we can develop like protocols, like templates, where you just sort of plug in the details of your own museum. And that's something that I think is happening more and more. Yes, ma'am.
Just for a little reason, did the Taliban have going after works of art?
Well, Islam forbids images. And so having the existence of images is something that at least officially is frowned on and forbidden in Islam, especially things like graven images or idols of other gods. That said, a lot of Islamic dynasties made images. The Seljuk Turks, for instance, in Anatolia, have beautiful carvings and things. The Taliban subscribe to a very, very puritanical form of Islam that wants to go back to basically the ideas, this is their own words, that they want to go back to the earliest generations of Islam in the 7th century, and their view is that this is anathema. So it was combined, the destruction of the Buddhas in Bamiyan, for instance, that was combined with the fact that the Taliban, as Pashtuns, really, 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 really hated the Hazaras and wanted to punish the Hazaras by destroying their greatest treasure. And that combined with their sort of fundamentalist ideology. So it was politics and religion coming together in the worst possible way. But that's part of the program. It's never just religion. It's always religion and politics. Yes, sir. Do I think the Taliban are going to become more moderate? That's really the $30 million question. No one knows. What everyone recognizes, even though they're not particularly happy about it, is the ultimate solution of this is going to have to be a political solution. And that means somehow bringing the Taliban into the political process. Whether or not they moderate their beliefs as part of it, we don't know. But one thing is clear is that Afghanistan has changed a lot in 10 years. And I don't know to what extent you can turn back the clock. I think there's a reasonable chance they'll regain power. I don't think that the Taliban of today will be as horrible as the Taliban of the late 90s. But that's a really risky bet to make. The safest answer is no one really knows. And one last question, if there are any. All right, well, listen, thank you very much for your patience, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend.